exercise as medicine.
I think the overall sense is that the more we learn about the effects of this drug, it's by far, in my opinion, the most powerful, wide-reaching, and effective drug we have. It works for almost every single condition, both for prevention and, in some cases, for treatment. Better than the drugs we have. And it's safe, and it's free, and it works for everybody. So they should all take it.
That's Dr. Jordan Metzl. We talk with him about his book, The Exercise Cure. And do you have a book you want to get published, but don't know how?
What we have to understand is that the game has now changed completely. The days of delivering your manuscript to a publisher and going home and sitting on your couch are over. Now, your author platform, your author marketing effort is more important than ever to make sure that your book reaches the widest possible audience.
That's publisher Randy Davila. He tells us how to market your book in his book, Think Like a Publisher. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Americans spend $365 billion a year on medications, $1 billion a day. When we're feeling sick, most of us reach for a pill. But my guest, Dr. Jordan Metzl, says not so fast. He says the most effective drug in many cases is exercise. We all know exercise is good for us, but Metzl says research is showing it's even better than we think. It doesn't just make for strong muscles and bones. It doesn't just improve heart and lung function. It also can help prevent certain kinds of cancer, cure mild to moderate depression, help people with ADHD focus, and soothe inflammatory bowel disease. Exercise can control diabetes, and there are indications it may even prevent or slow the progress of Alzheimer's. In his book, The Exercise Cure, Jordan Metzl discusses the research, but he also shows what you can do at home to create your own exercise regime tailored just for you. Whether you're young, middle-aged, or old, healthy or sick, a veteran exerciser or a newbie, The Exercise Cure has something for you. Dr. Jordan Metzl is a nationally known sports medicine doctor at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. He's a medical columnist for Triathlete magazine and is the author of two previous books about sports medicine. I sat down with Dr. Jordan Metzl in his office in January to talk about his book, The Exercise Cure. Dr. Jordan Metzl, welcome to Writer's Voice. You are an exerciser yourself with about 30 marathons and 11 Ironmans under your belt. Have you been a lifelong exerciser and you got into doing this book because of that? Did you come to it largely because of your work as a doctor?
I come to writing The Exercise Cure both as an athlete and as a doctor. And all the work I've done with this book, my previous one, Athlete's Book of Home Remedies, all the work I've done with Runner's World, I really approach as a doctor and an athlete at the same time. I think those two parts of my persona are really part of the whole, and I need them both. So on the athlete side, for example, this morning in Central Park, it was 8 degrees. There was a foot of snow on the ground, and there were a few of us out in Central Park running this morning at 6:30 in the dark. I was one, and I saw some other guy coming towards me. I'm like, who is that crazy guy? That was my brother. So I think from the athlete point of view, I'm kind of hardwired to move. And what I have found is that my patients who seek me out and see me all are wired to move of any age. Now, the other part of my life is that I'm a doctor, and I'm a sports medicine doctor here at Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. And what I do here is help get people back to activity. And my focus is teaching them how to not only help diagnose their injuries, but also how to teach them how to really fix their injuries themselves at home. And that's what I've really focused on.
I think a lot of times when people get injured, they think that they have to not move in order to recover. What's your doctorly advice to people? And of course, understanding that each situation will be different, but how do you deal with the getting back to exercise idea with people who have been injured?
So, you know, part of my ethos, again, as an athlete and as a doctor, is that I feel like there is no better medicine in the world than exercise. And so, you know, the idea of the exercise cure was to, first of all, I knew exercise made me feel good. The question beyond that was, you know, once you get past the feel-good medicine idea, how medicinal is exercise? So what I sought to do was to really look at the scientific evidence for exercise as medicine and, you know, starting with the brain and looking at some of the common problems we see, depression, anxiety, sleep disorders, attention deficit disorder. What's the scientific evidence for exercise as medicine instead of or in addition to medicine? How does it work? And so I really went down the human body by system and looked at some of the things we didn't, I don't think get as much notoriety, things like some of the mental issues and then some things which many people know, such as high blood pressure and high cholesterol, you know, all of which are treated very well with exercise. What's the evidence for the medicine of exercise as medicine? And then the second part is really how do you implement an exercise program for yourself?
In the exercise cure, you say that exercise is a miracle drug, a kind of panacea. When you talk about all these different ways, different disorders, in fact, in the book, you go through, as you say, different disorders. You talk about an exercise program, when to call the doctor when you actually need to. How does it actually work? And maybe it works differently with different disorders, but give us a sense of how it interacts with the brain and the body to be such a miracle drug.
First of all, I guess my comment is that human beings are meant to move. And if you look at our evolution and you know what we've come from, you know, we didn't drive to Costco, load up a bunch of pre-processed foods, you know, eat those foods, sit on the television, watch TV, go to bed, wake up, repeat. Like, we didn't do that. And for, you know, for centuries, we didn't do that. And our bodies are not hardwired to sit. Our bodies are designed to move and move many miles every day, to hunt, to gather, to fetch, to collect, to digest. That's what we're meant to do. And I think the further we get from that, the more problems we see. In the book, what I really wanted to do was to, I mean, again, as an athlete myself, I've always known my brain worked better, my body felt better when I exercised every day. I decided to take that argument a step further and try and see not only, you know, how true is that, but in what body system is that true? So, you know, I think the research on the brain was very compelling to me and very surprising just to the breadth of exercise. You know, the stuff on the heart. Certain types of cancer, particularly recurrent breast cancer and colon cancer, are very responsive to exercise. Information on arthritis and osteoporosis, inflammatory bowel disease. I mean, pretty much almost every chronic disease, diabetes. I have evidence on what's the scientific evidence for exercise as medicine in addition to or sometimes instead of medicine. And the reason I say that is because we have a medication-first society where we dispense pills for everything at the drop of a hat. We spend more than $375 billion a year on prescription medications. And if you have a problem, like a sleep problem, you know, you think the treatment for a sleep problem is open your window and that butterfly will come flying in your window and you'll have the best night's sleep of your life. Or if you have a problem with erectile dysfunction, you will take this pill, throw the football through the tire, and you'll live happily ever after with your wife for the rest of your life. Not stopping to think that each one of these drugs and all the other drugs have significant side effects. And those side effects cause problems for people. And I don't want people, I'm a Western-trained doctor. I'm not saying don't take medicine. I'm saying that the most powerful drug across the spectrum of the human body is exercise. And we need to start thinking about how we dispense this medicine and teach doctors in training about exercise as well.
So let's talk about some of those conditions because they're so disparate. Cancer, why would exercise help to prevent or help someone recover from breast cancer or colon cancer?
So I think we don't know everything, but what I think we are increasingly finding out in the past couple of years, there is a glycoprotein category called interleukins, and interleukins tell different cells what to do. I think much of the benefit of exercise, in my opinion, focuses on two things. Number one, it's just circulation, you know, perfusing your brain, perfusing your organs, you know, pumping blood and oxygen to things that if you sit your butt on the couch all day, you're not basically getting that same blood flow across your organs, which means less oxygenation, which means tissues die over time or they don't work as well. So for sure, there's that piece. But the other piece of this, I think, is this interleukin model. And so interleukin 6 is made by both fat and muscle. When interleukin 6 is made by fat, it has a pro-inflammatory response. So it basically makes everything chronic circulating inflammation in your body increase. When interleukin-6 is made by muscle, it has the exact opposite effect. It has an anti-inflammatory response. When you use your muscles 4 or 5 times a week and do things, you make more interleukin-6 from muscle. When you sit on your butt and don't do anything, you make more IL-6 from fat. So if you think about why different conditions respond well to exercise, I think it's some combination of this perfusion and also this IL-6 model, which makes a lot of sense in terms of why people are just healthier when they exercise. At the beginning of the book, I talk about all the different problems people can avoid and fix and treat if they move every day. And if that drug was commercially available, it would be the most popular drug in the entire world, and everybody would take it every day. And that's exactly my point.
I understand that inflammation is being seen as the root of many of the things that go wrong with us, particularly chronic diseases.
I think we don't know in medicine more than we know. But I think that in that spectrum, you know, chronic inflammation is not good, much like chronic stress is not good. And anything you can do to help treat that is better for you.
Now, on my way up here, I was checking out the New York Times, you know, in my little pocket edition there on my phone, and I saw an article that said they understand that exercise is beneficial, but they wanted to know what happens when you don't exercise. So they had a control group of rats who they exercised regularly and another group which was sedentary. And they found that there were actually changes in the brain. I wonder if you saw this. Changes in the brain that make the signals that the body sends, the brain sends a circulatory system more chaotic.
More chaotic in what way?
That somehow there are more capillaries that are created through the sedentary system, and so the body is getting signals about when to dilate the blood vessels and constrict the blood vessels in a chaotic way that actually sets up the system for inflammation and for some of these heart problems, circulatory problems. So I thought that was so interesting. The brain-body connection, talk a little bit more about that.
I mean, I think you can't open any newspaper or anything these days without seeing something or some study every week or two. A study comes out on the benefit of exercise for this problem, that problem, the other problem. And I think it's both mind and body. And I think the overall sense is that the more we learn about the effects of this drug, it's by far, in my opinion, the most powerful, wide-reaching, and effective drug we have. It works for almost every single condition, both for prevention and, in some cases, for treatment, better than the drugs we have. And it's safe, and it's free, and it works for everybody. So they should all take it.
And we're talking with Dr. Jordan Metzl about his book, The Exercise Cure, the doctor's all-natural, no-pill prescription for better health and longer life. Now, you also say that exercise can actually increase life expectancy. Is this just because we're healthier, or is there something about the telomeres in there? And if so, explain that.
So I think that the idea of exercise is that, you know, when you have better tissue perfusion, less inflammation, you're moving around more, you're just healthier. And that definitely increases your longevity. And more importantly, it increases the quality of the years you have. So I have my patients of all ages, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s. I get them on exercise programs as a big part of what I do, and I recommend that for them. The second half of the book, I talk all about how to set up an exercise program for yourself at home. And my focus on that is, you know, I'm not all about fancy personal trainers and fancy gyms. I want things people can do at home, and all these programs are home-based programs that you can do at home for under $50.
And there are some differences. You have, for example, a chapter on menopause. So there are certain things you prescribe. You actually prescribe different kinds of exercise for different kinds of situations. Talk about some of the differences, some of the ways in which people would want to set up a different exercise program depending on what was going on with them.
Yeah, what I tried to do was pull together and think about what was available. You know, the truth is this is still early on. So this book will be updated in years to come. But I think what we know is that, for example, in my section on the brain, I talk about the treatment of depression with exercise. And I reference a big study done in Norway where they had one group who did outdoor exercise 4 to 5 times a week and one group who took medications like Prozac. And they looked at how they did against each other. And the exercisers did better without the side effects of these other medicines, which have, you know, really lifelong implications, some of which are really not that good. So I try and look at conditions like that, outdoor exercise for depressive symptoms, you know, strength building exercise for problems of bone density. You know, what are some things to think about that you can do to help your condition, whether or not you're on these other medicines, or if you want to try and start getting off those medicines, you know, you can do that too.
Now, you suggest that people actually exercise every day. What about the idea that you have to let muscles rest?
I'm not a big believer in days off. I think you can do different things. So some days I have stretching, some days I have yoga, some days I have getting on a foam roller. In the book, I try and set up different gradations of exercise from what we call bronze level people who are just beginning, people who've never done anything and know they should do more, silver level people who are doing some and I want to teach them how to maximize the function of their kinetic chain, how to learn to strengthen and stretch their muscles on their own. I have a whole section in there on how to use a foam roller, which is one of God's gifts to flexibility. And then finally, in my gold section, these are for advanced level people who I want to teach them about plyometrics and functional strength training exercises so they can do their stuff at home. So I really try and give different gradations of the same type of thing.
Yeah, that foam roller, I took your suggestion. I have a few of them. And I usually use them. I don't use them to actually loosen up my muscles because I find it's very painful. So what do you suggest for somebody who is really trying to do the right thing and get muscles that are habitually tight to loosen up on a foam roller without screaming in agony?
Well, I generally tell my patients there's good pain and there's bad pain. The pain from foam roller is actually good pain. What you're doing is loosening up that muscle. Much like my strength workouts, what I tell people is you may hate me at the beginning, but you will learn to love me. And I think foam roller falls in that you will learn to love it category. As you start to do it more, it becomes a lot easier, less painful, and easier to do and tolerate.
And how do you do that? I mean, can you go just very slowly and not do it for minutes at a time?
The key is to do it for shorter periods of time and then build in a tolerance. That's the way to do it.
And so what about the intensity of exercise? What do you suggest with that? And obviously, it's going to be different for different people, but let's take somebody who's just picked up your book. They want to start their exercise program. And how do they ease into it? And how do they do it in a way that's going to push them forward rather than keeping them at a plateau?
So what I try to do is in the first half of the book, give the argument, and then the second half of the book, teach people how to set that up. I explain that in the first couple pages by what's called the exercise wheel, and it's a diagram that I think the best illustration is if there is a big tire, like a tractor tire, sitting on the road, and you want to get that tire up and roll it down the road 100 yards down the road, it takes the most energy to get that thing up and get it moving. Once it's moving, it takes very little energy to keep it moving, and I like that analogy for people and their exercise programs because the toughest part of this process is getting started. And once you make this a habit, it's the best kind of habit you can have. And then in the second half of the book, I talk about how you can set up your program and different things to do. And for my bronze level people that I talk about, or people who aren't doing anything at all, I try and give strategies to increase their NEAT profile. And NEAT's a nice concept I like to think about. NEAT is an acronym for non-exercise active thermogenesis, or in English, just burning calories from walking around. And I find that to be a very helpful message for people as they start to just move around and burn calories. Things like, you know, parking further away from their destination, or getting a dog, or thinking about family fitness activities, or things that will just make you walking to work, biking to work, make you more active. And when you're more active just in your everyday life, it really helps your health behaviors. I tell my patients, and I used to not, I wasn't sure if I believed this, but now I truly do. When you look at the public health campaign against smoking and you look at the known disease patterns from smoking, so things like high blood pressure, diabetes associated with smoking, heart disease, and you look at inactivity and you look at the health problems that come from inactivity, sitting on your butt for more than 6 hours in a row particularly, I think it's very fair to say that sitting is the new smoking, that inactivity carries the same health risks that smoking does. And if I said, I don't want you to smoke because I don't want you to get sick, you would buy that argument in a second because you've been beaten over the head for the last 20 years with anti-smoking messages. If I said, I want you to exercise so you don't get sick, you'd be a tougher sell because you're not used to that message. What I'm here to tell you is that public health questions are really identical. They're very similar.
And we're talking with Dr. Jordan Metzl about his book, The Exercise Cure. Now, how much exercise? And we say we should do it every day. How much should we do it?
I think when it comes to exercise, I'd love to see the minimum dose is 150 minutes a week, a half hour a day. That's the minimum required dose to get the maximum effect. Now, beyond that, everything is gravy, but that 150 minutes is your key to happiness, and that, I think, is the best stepping-off point for you.
I've read in the New York Times, I think it was Gretchen Reynolds is a reporter who's written about the six-minute high-intensity workout. What's your thought on that?
So I love increasing your intensity. I think you need that half hour to give me the 150 minutes, but you know, I think in the book, I try and talk through the different zones of exercise. So zone one is much like we're doing now, just normal conversation when walking. Zone two is, you know, it's tougher to talk because you're huffing and puffing a bit. In zone three, you can't talk at all because you're breathing so hard. What I tell my patients is I want a half your workout in zone one and then 25% in zones two and three, meaning for a fourth of your workout or a quarter of your workout, I really want you huffing and puffing. Now, I think 7 minutes isn't enough to get that done. But I think in a half-hour workout, that's certainly probably within the reasonable part of that part of the workout being very intense, and I think that's a reasonable thing to do. Intensity is important, not for the entire workout, but for part of the workout.
So you don't go with the idea that you can kind of get it all in if you're going to be doing it at the maximum amount for just 6 minutes a day?
I think you need a minimum half-hour a day.
And what would be the optimum? You know, something that somebody's not really wants to be an athlete, but, you know, kind of that middle range where they're getting better than the minimum.
I mean, I think that anything over a half hour is great. The maximum effect kicks in at 150 minutes a week. Beyond that, it's kind of whipped cream and cherries and nuts on top of your sundae, but the actual sundae is 150 minutes a week.
I was surprised to see Alzheimer's on the list of conditions that, I mean, can you really say that with some confidence that exercise is preventive against Alzheimer's?
When you look at the research on dementia and Alzheimer's, which is a form of dementia, the only drug which has shown to slow the progression of dementia is exercise. It's the only drug that works.
Now, why do you call it a drug? I mean, I get the feeling that's not just a cute thing.
No, I mean, this is, if I said the only drug is X that slows the progression of Alzheimer's, you'd say, give me X. I'm saying exercise is that X. It's the only drug that works. And I think I want people to think about exercise as a drug because that's what it is. It changes health profiles. It changes disease. And I want you to think about that much like you think about other drugs.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about when people have been injured? You're an orthopedist. You work with people who've been injured. I can offer my own situation. I was hit by a truck a couple of years ago while I was on my bike. I broke the top of my tibia. And now I've been told that I should not run. I can bicycle, but I shouldn't run. Is that true? Is it not true? Are there similar kinds of cautions for when people have been injured?
So in my practice every day, I try and help dispense this medicine of exercise. And part of how I dispense that is teaching people how to move and be active and hopefully not only to prevent injury, but to treat injury when it happens. I always tell people about a couple things, including number one, different body types are built better for different activities. So some people are just naturally built for running or swimming or whatever sport it is they want to do. And then second of all, there's a lot you can do to maximize the body that you have. And that really falls around what's called the kinetic chain of the body. So kinesis comes from the Greek root to move. And the kinetic chain of the body, or the movement chain of the body, is what keeps you moving. And the better your kinetic chain function, the better you are. So what makes a kinetic chain work includes strength and flexibility. The flexibility piece is the foam roller. The strength piece is this home-based strengthening. In other words, if you have an arthritic knee and you come to see me and you say, hey, doc, I have some arthritis in my knee, I can't run. What I say is two things. A, let's see how much arthritis there is. Let's examine you, get an x-ray, et cetera. And B, let's look at how strong your kinetic chain is, how flexible it is. Because it may be you have arthritis that's bugging you with the kinetic chain you have now, but if we work on your muscles and your flexibility, the kinetic chain you will have, your knee won't hurt as much or maybe not at all. So there's never a one-size answer to that. The answer is that I can change the kind of body you have, and with that, I can make the symptoms you're having better and you can make your symptoms better. And that's what I'm all about, is teaching people how to do that on their own so they can take this medicine.
So somebody who has osteoarthritis could actually change, I mean, it's not reversible per se, so what exactly does exercise do to change it?
Well, what I'm talking about here is that the stronger the muscular force around the joint, the less loading force on the joint. In other words, the act of exercising and building strength is changing the loading force on the joint and making that joint less symptomatic and making you feel better so you can move. So in essence, the medicine of exercise is changing how your disease is really affecting your body.
Now, I was told by my orthopedist that I should bicycle in order to develop the muscles around it. You think somebody like myself could actually run?
Again, I don't know what your x-rays look like, but certainly there's no reason why you couldn't if the arthritis is not so advanced. But again, it's your responsibility, and what I want in my book is to teach you how to start doing it for yourself. I want you to learn how to do your own strengthening. I want you to learn how to get on that foam roller, and I want you to make sure you do that so we can then see how your arthritic symptoms respond. I think people often fall on this path, in this kind of cycle of, all right, my x-ray looks like this, I have arthritis, I can't do anything. And what I say is, you have to do more. You have to do more, not less. And the more you do, I don't want you to be despondent, I don't want you to be discouraged, because if you think about that wheel analogy I gave you, when that tire slows down and tips over, it's so much harder to get that tire off the couch. So you got to get moving yourself to keep that going.
And I can say that this is the book to help you do it. It is The Exercise Cure. Dr. Jordan Metzl, is there anything I didn't ask you that you would like to add?
I really want people to take this message, to think about it, and to think about exercise as a drug that they want to take every day of their lives. I think if you take this drug, you will lead a longer, happier, healthier life. It's not just something that makes you feel good. This is the strongest and most powerful medicine we have.
Plus, it's fun.
Most importantly, it's great. It's a great time, and it's great for you.
Dr. Jordan Metzl. Again, his book is The Exercise Cure. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to some of his exercise videos for Runner's World. Next up, some advice for writers who want to sell their book. We talk with publisher Randy Davila about his book, Think Like a Publisher. That's coming up right after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The publishing industry has changed radically just in the 10 years that Writer's Voice has been on the air. Authors have a lot more venues open to them to publish, including self-publishing. But whether a book is published the traditional way or self-published, authors need to do a lot more of the heavy lifting in marketing their books. My guest, Randy Davila, runs Hampton Roads and Hierophant Publishing, which publish books in the self-help and spiritual genres. In his book, Think Like a Publisher, Davila sets out 33 essential tips to help authors write, promote, and sell their books. I started out our conversation by asking him who his book was for.
Well, this book is really designed for, you know, the author who is either already writing or considering writing, or even authors who maybe already have a book out, especially a self-published book. But hopefully for those that are earlier in the process, and because I believe that creating a good book is a combination of four things: art, inspiration, craft, and marketing. And most writers that I come into contact with are well tapped into the art and inspiration portion, but they really need to learn the craft of writing, and they really need to understand the marketing aspect of the book business. So my book is designed to educate new writers primarily on some of the more common mistakes that I see that new writers make and how to avoid them from an editorial standpoint, but also to see the big picture, how you position a book, how you angle a book, you know, how you sculpt your manuscript, not only from an editorial standpoint, but also from a marketing to your targeted audience. So the key word really throughout the book is focus, focus, focus. Focus your writing and focus your marketing efforts, your platform building efforts. So, because as you know, in today's world, an author really needs to do both. And it's not just about writing the book and sending it off to a publisher as it once was.
It used to be not that long ago that, you know, you handed a manuscript over either to a publisher or to an agent, and that was it. And the publisher did the marketing. What's gone on in the media landscape now around book promotion?
The publishing world has changed dramatically in just the last few years. I mean, think about it. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, Francesca, if you wanted to buy a book in this country, how'd you do it?
Well, I went to the bookstore.
Yeah, you went to the bookstore. That was it. That was your only choice. You went to the bookstore. You went to the category section in the bookstore that you wanted to buy. You looked on the shelf space, and you chose from the limited number of books on a limited shelf space in that category. What did that mean? Well, consequently, if you were one of the lucky few authors to get picked up by a traditional publishing company, and your book was printed and put on the shelf in bookstores around the country, you were almost guaranteed a modicum of success because there were so few books being published, and the way to purchase them was really, that was the only way. Well, you know, look around. The world has changed. Is that how we buy books these days? No, and more importantly, it's not even how we learn about the books, how we choose the books. I mean, certainly, I love bookstores, and a lot of bookstore buying still going on. But what's changed is when you go into a bookstore today to purchase a book, 80% of the time, you know what that book is before you arrive. You've already done your research on the internet or in the information age. You've already been bombarded by, you know, all sorts of book ideas and topics, et cetera. And so the model has shifted so dramatically. And combine that with the fact of more books coming to market via ever before being self-publishing. Readers have more choices than ever before and greater access, which I love. But what we have to understand as publishers and authors is that the game has now changed completely. The days of delivering your manuscript to a publisher and going home and sitting on your couch are over. Now, your author platform, your author marketing efforts, in other words, everything else you're doing in addition to writing a book, is more important than ever to make sure that your book reaches the widest possible audience.
So you've got a lot more access to the audience, but also a lot more competition for that audience.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think more books have come to market in the last 2 years than in the previous 100 years before that, given the technology changes, which, again, is wonderful. But readers have far more choices than they've ever had. And so publishing now, traditional publishing, is a partnership between author and publisher. I don't look at, oh, can I buy a manuscript? No, no, no. That's the olden days. Sell your manuscript to a publisher. I don't even like that language and terminology. I think it's a misrepresentation. Nowadays, I say, who can I partner with? You know, who is willing, who's written a great book and is willing to do the work so that I can do everything on my end to get this book into the best possible shape, and together we can bring it to the world and combine our marketing and promotional efforts to reach the widest possible audience to get the book to reach to a tipping point so that it then begins to sell on its own.
One of the things you talk about that is so important for every would-be or actual author to have is a platform. What do you mean by a platform, and what could be some of the different ways in which that manifests for a writer?
Yeah. So, you know, a platform is essentially, think of it as your soapbox. You know, or who's listening to you now? Who's in your tribe? What other things are you doing in addition to writing your book to connect with people about your topic or storyline if you're writing a memoir or fiction? You know, what other activities are you involved in? And the reason for that is because, you know, you want to let the world know that you are either an expert on a particular topic or a master storyteller, and that you have a book coming out. And so you begin to connect with those folks, and you begin to build your tribe. And these people are very, very important because they are the most likely candidates who's going to buy your book when it first comes out. This is what I call, this is your home team. These are the people that are going to hopefully buy your book, like it, and refer it to someone else. And that's critical. So let me give you two kind of platform examples. You know, let's take Jon Stewart, for instance, the host of the comedy show The Daily Show. And, you know, his platform would be that he has a talk show. So this is a mega platform. He has a talk show, and he speaks to viewers, you know, five nights a week. And so, as you know, Jon has written a couple of books of political satires. And so just by his ability to go out and say, hey, I have a new book, you know, that sends people around the country to stores in droves to purchase his new book. So that's a mega platform. That's a huge platform. Well, we have an author, a self-help author, Sonny Dawn Johnston, who's written a book called Invoking the Archangels, A Nine-Step Process to Heal Your Body, Mind, and Soul, who is a very active speaker in niche circles. I mean, she travels and speaks at a lot of self-help conferences. She, you know, has her own little center that she teaches classes at there in Phoenix. So she's really built a very strong teaching platform and communication platform via her lecture circuit prior to her book coming out, which really got her book off to a fast start. But there are all sorts of other ways. You know, and that's the biggest thing that I hear from authors. Oh, gosh, platform. Well, you know, I tell authors, don't be discouraged by that. Remember, every best-selling author you ever heard of at one point didn't have a platform. But you want to start to think along those lines. And, of course, my book shares several tips on how to do that. You can use social media and traditional press and, you know, radio, et cetera, where you begin to connect with people who are interested in your topic or your ideas and get them excited about you and ultimately your book when it comes out.
You even talk about going on meetup.com and finding people who might be interested in, you know, reaching out to them to talk with them or connect with them.
Yeah, meetup.com is a great resource, I think. You know, and this is, it's just one example, but there's meetup groups, quote unquote, meetup, meetup.com. You can go to this website and enter your zip code and then your area of interest, anything from, you know, basket weaving to parasailing to, you know, just you'd be surprised at how many people are forming groups and then actually getting together in person at coffee shops and at bookstores and at other places and discussing these things. So that's a wonderful way to begin to meet people in your own community and that's topic driven, that have an interest in what you're writing about. And so you can begin to start to spread, you know, your awareness of who you are and what you're doing very, very early on. I mean, one of the things that new authors often tell me is, yeah, as soon as my book comes out, I'll start building my platform. And, you know, that's the wrong idea. You know, the time to start building your platform was yesterday, meaning that, you know, there's no harm. In fact, it's a huge benefit to begin to share your ideas with an open hand as soon as possible and start to connect with people, because that way when your book comes out, there will be a host of folks who are ready to buy it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Randy Davila about his book, Think Like a Publisher, 33 Essential Tips to Write, Promote, and Sell Your Book. Now, so far we've been talking about the promotion of the book. You also give some tips about writing. Let's start with the title, and I'm actually going to give you a personal example on this because I was quite struck. I've been working on a book for a long time. In fact, I started this radio show to get me a platform for the book 10 years ago, and then the radio show kind of became front and center. But it's a book about an underground group in Holland during the war that my father was involved with. It was headed by a gay German emigre poet that rescued Jewish refugees in Holland. It's a fascinating story. And for all these years, I've been calling it The Argonauts. It's an obscure reference because actually a friend of the leader of the group was the painter Max Beckmann, and it's widely rumored that one of the figures in his painting, The Argonauts, was this man who was the leader of the group. So I read your book, and you said the title's really important. What's wrong with my title?
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about the, you know, what makes a good title in general, and then we can address yours, you know, specifically. Because title is absolutely critical. It's absolutely critical, especially in today's world of publishing, in the information age, when readers have more choices than ever before about the books they choose to read. So what you want to convey to the reader, if you're writing a nonfiction book, and we'll hold memoir out as on the side, but in nonfiction, anything other than memoir, your job in your title is to describe the contents of that book as closely as possible. In other words, you want to tell the reader exactly what they are getting as best you can in the title of that book. So my case in point is if you have a title, many authors, first-time authors and new writers, they come to a title that, and they say, oh, I say, well, you know, what does that title mean to you? And they say, well, when you read the book, you get to page 55, you'll know why I gave the book that title. And so the problem is that most readers won't get to page 55 because they won't have been energized about the title enough to pick up the book and read it. In addition to that, I often see where an author wants to be witty or cute in the title. And if you can do that and still describe the contents of your book, that's great. But never, ever sacrifice description in order to be witty or cute. So the example that I use is, you know, we picked up a self-published book. I picked up a self-published book a couple of years ago and republished it under Hampton Roads. So here was an author that had written a fantastic manuscript. I liked it very much. His book had not performed well as a self-published. And in part, I think it was due to this title. The title of this book was The New Bridge. So, Francesca, think for a moment, you know, what all possible topics or, you know, that book could be about. It's The New Bridge. You know, I mean, is it architecture? is it a bridge building book? I mean, it's, you just saw that title, but, you know, I'm a you know, my vein of publishing is so you might think it's about relationships, et cetera. But no, you'll be interested to know that I republished that book without changing anything about the manuscript as The Extraterrestrial Answer Book.
I know, that was interesting. Well, I read this with, you know, as you can tell, with great interest, and I realized that my title, The Argonauts, you'd have to read well into my book to know why it was called The Argonauts.
And you, absolutely.
And you say in your book that you should say exactly what it's about. So I came up with a new title. And can I run it by you?
Yeah, let's hear it.
And then you can tell me if it's too long or whatever. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
The Illegals, How an Underground Group Led by Gay Poets Saved Jewish Refugees in Wartime Amsterdam and Made My Father a Hero.
I love it. I love that. That's you hit it. That's exactly right. So is it a little long? Sure. Can we try and shorten that up a little bit? Yeah. But you use your title and your subtitle to tell the reader exactly what the book is about. Now, people who are interested in that type of history and in that, which, you know, as a history minor, that sounds quite fascinating to me, will know, hey, this is a book I want to read. The Argonauts, they could be thinking, gee, is this,
Greek myths.
Greek mythology? Is it, you know, what is going on? and so I think that's definitely a step in the right direction and a very good real-life example. Thank you for that.
Now,
can I talk about fiction and memoir a little bit?
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go. So take it away. You talk about fiction and nonfiction, but memoir, and even I would argue creative nonfiction, can be a little bit of both.
Right, and certainly novels as well. So in the latter, your title shouldn't describe the criteria for a good title is not one that describes the contents of the book like nonfiction. The goal there is to be suggestive of the contents of the book, certainly. But more importantly, you want to be intriguing and inviting to the potential reader. Because really what you're saying with a memoir or with a novel is, come, let me tell you a story. I want to take you on a journey. I'm a master storyteller, and I've got one that you really need to hear. And so in that way, you know, it gets back to the primary purpose of fiction and the primary purpose of nonfiction and why this title is so important. You know, the primary purpose of all nonfiction books, with the exception of, you know, creative and memoirs, is to educate the reader about a particular topic. You know, that it's to teach. And the primary purpose of every fiction or memoir is to entertain the reader. That's the primary purpose. Now, I realize that great fiction not only entertains the great memoirs, but they also educate, but that education is the secondary purpose. In the same way, great nonfiction books not only educate, but they also entertain. We refer to them, oh, it was a fun read. But the reason for that is you have to remember that's why readers are going to these books. One is to learn something, the other is to be entertained primarily. And the biggest mistake that I see on submissions from new authors is that they don't, quite honestly, respect the primary purpose of their genre, nonfiction and fiction, that they get those confused. For instance, if you're writing a fiction or memoir, I often see that authors have ideas about the way the world should be and how people should behave, and they begin to put words and phrases in their character's mouth that are unnatural, and they beat the reader over their head with their ideas, with what they want to teach the reader, and use the vehicle of story. And that is a big, big turnoff to readers. You know, that's when we say, "Oh, gee, that novel either had an agenda or it was too preachy," or you know. And so you can certainly teach in your novel, but you've got to weave that teaching deftly into your tale. Use your plot, use your characters, you know, show, not tell. Let the story do the teaching. In nonfiction, you know, an example is where we see an author, instead of writing a very focused book that is designed to educate, they start to go off on tangents. They start to try and include too much, or try and be cute and funny, and it's not working, or they will tell too much of their own personal story in the process. So somebody's come to a book to learn about a particular topic, and the author spends a lot of time talking about themselves. You know, all these things can be turnoffs to readers. And so it gets back to the idea that I said earlier about focus. You know, when you write a nonfiction book, you need to be very focused on your topic and your one main idea, the takeaway that you want readers to get, And when you're writing fiction or memoir, it needs to be very focused on your story, on the plot, and on the characters. And everything that happens in that book needs to support that.
Although I can see times when you would want to mix genres in a way, although I think it's a difficult thing. I mean, this is something I'm struggling with my book, because I didn't know my father, didn't grow up with him. I learned about him through learning about this history, which I learned about because I wanted to find out about him. And I've decided to make that part of the story so that there is some memoir involved in the history. And it's a tricky thing, but it's something mm-hmm. that I feel the reader is going to want to know. It's going to make mm-hmm. the story more compelling. In other words, I'm going to invite the reader to find out about this group kind of in the way that I found out about my father, that the journey is the same. Is that something mm-hmm. that makes sense to you, or do you think...
It does. It does. So there are cases when there is a little bit of a mixing going on, but you need to understand that your primary needs to be very clear, meaning is this a memoir or is this a history book, so to speak, because that's going to determine what category it goes in the bookstore, and that's going to determine how it's marketed. And so I get that in cases like this, and yours is a particularly good example of one which there's a little bit of mix. But I think one story has to be predominant, and that meaning is it the story that happened 60, mm-hmm. 70 years ago, and then yours is the supporting narrative, or is your story the primary one, and this story is just simply supporting that and making it interesting? Now, you can write it either way, but whichever way you choose is going to speak to how you're going to angle and position the book. Does that make sense?
That does make a lot of sense. So now I want to move on. We in the short time that we have left, I'd like you to talk a little bit about self-publishing, because I remember 10 years ago when I started this radio show, self-publishing was really looked down upon. And now mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. not. It has really come into the mainstream. But there are some caveats you talk about in your book, Randy Davila, Think Like a Publisher. Talk about self-publishing and what you should look for and what you shouldn't.
I love self-publishing. I really do. Because I love books and I love writing, and it gives authors a chance to get their voice out there that they otherwise would not have had a chance. Now, but here's the problem. Is that the majority of authors who choose to self-publish don't get an education prior to doing so. and meaning they write a book or they write a manuscript, they show it to maybe their few closest friends, and then they submit it and get it either publish an ebook or put it as a printed book and stick it up on Amazon and think that, I'm done, And of course, you and I know that that's not the case. Then they're very, very disappointed and the results of the book. So, first, before I move on to, the second half of your question, the first thing is I can't stress the importance of getting an education on the publishing business and how to position your book, how to focus it, learning about the importance of title and of cover and back cover copy and all the other marketing things that you can do to give your book a chance to reach a wide as possible audience. If you do what I just said, so many do, just write it, stick it up on Amazon, and keep your fingers crossed, 99.99999% of the time, you're going to be very, very disappointed if your goal was that your book reach a wide audience. Now, the second thing is when you come to choosing a company to help you self-publish, that is something that you need to get educated on as well. So I go into detail about this in the book, but the short answer is that most of the time, self-published author only looks at the upfront price of the self-publishing company is going to charge them for getting their book out there in the world. And they say, oh, this price is great, this is the best price. Well, if you do that, you're really doing yourself a disservice because you're not looking at the whole picture. There's two other very important components. So certainly price, looking at the price is important, and seeing all that you get for that price. In other words, do they include copy editing or proofreading and how many cover concepts do you get to choose from, and you know, in distribution, and what are all the things that you really got to take time to educate to see what that company offers for their set fee. But the second thing you have to look at is you want to see how much money you will receive every time your book sells on Amazon.com or on BNN.com or, you know, or possibly even in the bookstores if it makes it in there as a self-published book. We call that selling through the trade. Now, here's where I see authors really don't pay attention and fall for some, what I think, quite frankly, is very misleading language. Because some self-publishing companies say things like, we pay 100% of the royalty, and then there's a little asterisk after cost, you know. Well, that begs the question, you know, what are these costs? Whereas another self-publishing company might say, we pay a 30% royalty. So a question that you want to present to each self-publishing company that you, when you get to your final selection mode is if my book has a cover price of $20 and sells on Amazon, how much of that money, of that $20 book, will I receive? And then if the company that offered you 100% of royalty says, well, you get 50 cents, and the company that offered you 30% of royalty says, well, you get $6 or $6.66, then you realize, hey, wait a minute, this is a financial consideration here, you know, because company A with 100% of the royalty might have offered you a very low upfront price, and company B might have had a higher price. But, you know, you've got to look at the entire picture. And then the last thing that you know, and this is very important, this is the one that authors just, for whatever reason, don't seem to think about in almost all cases, and that is you've got to find out what can you, the author, what discount from the cover price can you buy your finished book from? And I'm going to say it needs to be at least 50%. And the reason for that is when we talked about platform and you going out and building your tribe, and so part of that will be you'll be selling your own books. And so if you can buy if you have a $20 book that you can buy for $10 and then resell for $20, you have a big incentive to do so, and you are going to make up your investment in the self-publishing very, very quickly. Now, some self-publishing companies, though, offer you a very low upfront fee, and then they offer you a small discount or no discount on purchasing finished books on the back end. So consequently, you have no benefit to purchasing books and building your platform and going out and selling them, which is integral to the long-term success of the book. So what I'd like to challenge is most authors is in those cases, that particular self-publishing company is planning on selling books to you, and that they may have charged you a very low upfront fee because they also know that you're average going to buy a certain amount of books on the back end. So you've got to look at all three of those things. The upfront fee, what is the amount of money you'll receive for each book that sells through the trade, and what percentage off the cover price can you buy books for?
Well, that's great advice. And there's plenty of more great advice in your book, Randy Davila, Think Like a Publisher. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Randy Davila. His book is Think Like a Publisher. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the Authors Community, a Facebook page for authors Randy Davila hosts. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.